I'm on. Well, there are two other pieces I want to add that I think help us bring this together. I think as I've shared those first two chapters and the preface and the notes, which I commend you to, invite us deeply into those questions of our image of God, how that grows and changes, our image of the soul, our experience as well as our image, and then how we bring those together in thinking what life after life might be. And I want to conclude by sharing a couple of things that speak to that for me very powerfully. One is by a wonderful writer I've just discovered. Her, I get all my good books from NPR. So when I'm riding around in the car, I'm jotting things down. And when I hear authors interviewed and speak in a personal way about their material, it really helps. This book has just come out. It's called Here If You Need Me. And it's written by Kate Breerschrupp, who is a chaplain for the wardens up in Maine. These are the fish and game people. And they go out and do the difficult job of informing people when there's a death. They locate bodies in the wilderness. They're very involved. And she's the chaplain for them. Yes.
There's an article about her in Oprah, either this
book. Oh, great.
There's this kind of feature article about her own personal story that's really
interesting. Great. It is her, this book is her personal story, and she tells it so beautifully.
Can you spell the last name?
Yes. It's Breerschrupp. Breerschrupp. Kate. And what I want to share with you from her book is her decision. When her husband, who was a state trooper, was killed very tragically and suddenly in an automobile accident, she made the decision that she wanted to prepare his body. And you can imagine this not only upset the funeral director, but also the state troopers. You know, nobody ever did this before. And she said, not only am I going to prepare his body, but I'm going to go with it and view the cremation. I'm going all the way. He would do that for me. And so she writes about this, and I just, her description is so powerful, and I think brings these questions to bear. Okay. Trooper Tom came to the house Wednesday morning to tell me that I would be permitted to tend to Drew's body. Isn't that interesting? We get permission to care for our own loved one. They wanted me to talk you out of this, Trooper Tom said. I told them that I've known you for a long time and I've never been able to talk you out of anything. And neither has anyone else. Thank you, I said. So they said I should go with you, and Sergeant Drake and Sergeant Cunningham are coming too. That's all right, and I'll go, said her mother. At the funeral home, the door of the cool, ordinary room was opened, and there he was. He was dead. And I will not lie, he looked dead. But it was a comfort and a joy and a sweet relief, not horror or pain, to see his body there. Drew lay on a white enameled steel table. He had one bruise on his right thigh. He wore the novelty Halloween boxer shorts that our son Zachary had chosen for him, and a t-shirt over his chest, which was thickly bandaged. A neat tonsure of staples circled his head. His hands rested at his side. My husband's smell was at home in our bed, and his white cereal bowl was still in the sink. My husband had an incision in his chest, and the top of his head was held on by staples. My husband left himself 3 days before, 2 miles from this cool room. He was gone the instant the red and clear glass was shattering, flying, shining in air. My husband might already have been reincarnated as a tiger. She goes on to say, I washed Drew's face with a soft, damp cloth. This is what Drew would have done for me, I thought. And in all the time that I shall live without him, time roaring and tumbling at me like some merciless black avalanche, I will be able to tell myself that I bore our love with my own hands all the way to the last hard place. I told him, washing him tenderly, the mouth, the jaw, the closed eyes, then soothing his hair with my hand, leaving the room where Drew's body lay harder than it was to enter it. So our experience has a lot to do with how we image God. For Kate, he'd left 3 days before. And there was something to be said for that experience for her. It shaped her thinking. And she goes on to write about this very beautifully, very poetically. And I think that has certainly been my experience being with people in the moment of death. They're gone. I don't think anything has affirmed my sense that there's something beyond, even though I don't have it all worked out, than being with people when they go. Because we leave. We leave. We go. Well, one other piece, and again, I was a school teacher, so I'm always looking for wonderful resources, and this is one on end of life that is fabulous. It's called Graceful Passages, if you're not familiar with it. It was put together as a CD of readings and music to play for someone when they're dying. And one of the readings I want to offer you, because again, it's another image of this transition, and I think it's a great blessing, and it was written by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she actually reads it on the CD. She writes, "Look forward to your transition. It is the first time you will experience unconditional love. There will be all peace and love, and all the nightmares and turmoil you went through in your life will be like nothing. When you make your transition, you are asked two things, basically. How much love have you been able to give and receive, and how much service have you rendered? And you will know every consequence of every deed, of every thought, of every word you have uttered. And that is, symbolically speaking, going through hell, when you see how many chances you've missed. But you also see how a nice act of kindness has touched hundreds of lives that you were totally unaware of. So concentrate on love while you're still around, and teach your children early to love unconditionally. So remember, concentrate on love and look forward to your transition. It's the most beautiful experience you can imagine." Well, we do touch the realm of imagination in all of this, don't we? Our image of God is something we feed out of our imagination as well as our experience. So I want to leave you with these three questions. What are your images of God, or what is your image of God? What is the nature of the soul? And how do those things come together for you to inform you about what may be next? I think we discover this by reflecting on our own stories and experiences, by meditating on our own death, and by spending time in the wonders of creation. Those are our teachers. And I want to close by offering you, for me, what has become a very powerful image of this whole experience of transition. Years ago, my husband and I had an opportunity to go on sabbatical in Scotland, and we both love Scotland, and we ended up in a very small village in the Highlands called Dornick. It actually has one of the best golf courses in the world, which was part of the reason we were there. But it gave me a lot of time for writing and reflection, and there's a beautiful, incredible beach there, miles and miles. So I walked every day, and the time of year we were there, the whelk shells, and this is a full whelk. Maybe many of you have seen them. We don't have this particular shape. It's a little different here in California. But the whelk shells were everywhere. And so as I did my daily walks, I would find whelks in various stages of what I call growth. The complete ones didn't interest me. They were interesting, but I began to find that the ones that were worn and weathered really drew me. And so I would come home every day with my little collection and sort through, and our little cottage was just, you know, whelk shells everywhere. They were everywhere. And I would touch them and listen to them. And when it came time to come home, I knew I couldn't take them all. So I had to make carefully some selections. And then there was for me the ceremony or ritual of returning them to the beach and prayerfully thinking about the people who might discover them. Well, with whelk shells, what happens is in these various stages, they get down to this. And quite honestly, this to me is the most valuable part of a whelk shell. You don't find many of these. They're not really common. But this is the whelk shell after it's tumbled and rolled and been out to sea and back to the sand, and it's worn away to nothing. But this nothing is the strongest part. The strongest part of the whelk shell. So I began to think about that in terms of my life. You know, I want to be used up when I go. All that tumbling and weathering and struggle has to be worth something. So when I got home to Santa Barbara, I opened my Spirituality and Health magazine, which is a wonderful resource, and there was the poem I could have written by Mary Oliver. And I'd like to close with this poem. It's called Whelks, that I think kind of for me, using poetry, with Kathleen Fisher says is something we can do, brings these threads together about soul and image of God, and it speaks very deeply to me. Here are the perfect fans of the scallops, quake hauls and weedy mussels still holding their orange fruit. And here are the whelks, whirlwinds, each the size of a fist, but always cracked and broken. Clearly they have been traveling under the blue waves for a long time. All my life I have been restless. I have felt there is something more wonderful than gloss, than wholeness, than staying at home. I have not been sure what it is, but every morning on the wide shore, I pass what is perfect and shining to look for the whelks, whose edges have rubbed so long against the world. They have snapped and crumbled. They have almost vanished with the last relinquishing of their unrepeatable energy back into everything else. When I find one, I hold it in my hand and I look over that shaking fire. I shut my eyes. Not often, but now and again there's a moment when the heart cries out, yes, I am willing to be that wild darkness, that long blue body of light. Thank you. Questions or answers?
The story about the dancing god you talked about, where he spun.
Yes.
Where did that come from?
Well, actually, that is a version told by Yogi Bhajan, and he is a Kundalini yoga yogi. But I've heard it in different ways. It may be from the Vedic writings. Yeah. Vedic Hindu writings. Yes.
Monday at the Mind Supermind, when Hank Sassi spoke, he said that after acceptance, people often experience chaos, which actually human fear, tremendous fear. There's people's individual concept, image of God, affect that moment, where they may not have fear or have fear. How do you explain that chaos, that fear?
That's an incredible question. And I can only reflect on it from my experience. I think we die how we live. So if we live in fear, and I put this out as something to explore. I'm not pontificating here in any way, but my experience has been that we die how we live. And it's interesting to me how many clergy I've been with that are afraid. And it's all traditions, but who have the hardest time. It's like if you've inculcated a theology and it comes to the rough moment, does it carry you through? And I found a lot of clergy are very, very frightened. I also have found some that, you know, are joyous and ready to go. But so that comes to mind. But if we've lived authentically and we've confronted our fears, I think that fear transforms into a kind of grief of leaving behind. It doesn't become fear so much as it becomes that sense of, I'm going to miss out. And I don't think that's fear as much as it is, darn, I really want to be here for that. So I also think people who have spent a lot of time reflecting on death seem not to have had the fear experience. It's like it's those of us who say, oh, well, that'll take care of itself, or that'll come sometime. Or people whose image of God is of a very negative, authoritative individual or judgment. I remember once, and this was very painful for me, this family who wanted their loved one to not be given any pain medication as they moved into their transition because they wanted them to have an opportunity to confess everything. Yeah. I could not believe it. And the individual could not speak for themselves, so you have to look to the family. And it was horrendous. And, you know, that kind of experience affects everybody, the staff, the physician, everybody is affected by that. But that concept, so was there fear there? I think for everybody, yeah. Certainly for the patient who's not having their pain managed, but what a way to face death. We're going to let him suffer so he can get it all out. And then, so in response to your question, it's an excellent question. There's a lot. That's what opens up a whole conversation. I hope that maybe there's a few things to think about. Yeah.
Is Kubler Ross still alive?
No.
She died in a rest home, I think.
She had a very long, incredible life. I think she was a mystic. I think she had experience. When you write something like that, and you hear it in her voice.
I was privileged to know her brother-in-law.
Incredible. Yes.
I'd love to clarify that because I always loved Kubler Ross and her writings and thought she was so insightful on the process. But I heard that her ending is she lost all faith and belief. She was in despair, that she had tremendous fear.
I didn't hear that, but I do think, Elizabeth Kubler Ross, who really led a movement that was impacted hospice and all sorts of things. I haven't heard that. I know she struggled with pain a great deal at the end. And, you know, think of Mother Teresa, what we know now about her own absence of God. So there are no guarantees in any of this. There are no guarantees. But I, you know, it's like my saying the clergy, who, you know, you'd think, gee, they've been living the religious life forever. They'd be the examples for us, and it's not. Yes?
Don't you think a lot of that fear comes from that concept that God is a vengeful and punishing God and purgatory and hell and all of this stuff? And when I was growing up in the 40s and 50s, that's the image of God that I was taught.
It
and,
may,
and I don't believe it anymore, but
yeah.
I think a lot of clergy do, and you hear it in the fire of their sermons.
Well, and it may be. There's one of those very individual things. Do you buy it or don't you? And what is your, how's your experience in reinformed you in some way? Also, remember there are a lot of people who fear that have no experience of the spiritual tradition. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who have no fear that have no spiritual tradition. Mm-hmm. So it's such, I think that's why this topic is so rich and informative for us. I mean, talk to your neighbors about it. Talk it up with people that have a different perspective than you. See where they come from. Because each of us has been, as you say, informed by history. I remember I was raised a Presbyterian, and my parents had been American Baptists when I was little, but then moved to another community, and the only Baptist church was a Southern Baptist. And that preacher every Sunday, you know, shook his fist and pounded the Bible, and that's not what my people do. So we changed to be Presbyterians. But, you know, I think had I stayed in that kind of environment, how would that have impacted me? So thank you. Yes?
This is related somewhat to the fear idea, and it would take another whole topic and talk. But I think part of it is also the relationship to how you face losses in your life, no matter what the loss is. Mm-hmm. And then you reach to the end, and you're ready to either give up and accept or not. And so I think that has a relationship to it also.
Mm-hmm. But then there's the variable of pain.
Well, mm-hmm.
And my experience there is pain that comes upon people with different... Well, I think bone cancer, and that, you know, we move into the realm of conscious sedation or some way to keep people. I think the idea now is to keep people comfortable and as present as they can in the process. And think of it, we're living so much longer. People don't live to this age in developing nations, you know. I mean, we're old. I mean, in terms of the world, you know, people didn't live that we read and how they reflect on all this. Some of them didn't live to their 50s and 60s or 70s. You know, it just didn't happen. My mother-in-law's 99. And, you know... That's incredible. She wakes up every day kind of surprised. Like, oh, well. And she's gone beyond fear, denial. She's just like, whoa. And I kind of want to adapt or adopt that perspective, because what a wonderful way to just wake up every morning and think, wow, I'm still here. Yes.
The average lifespan of the American male at the turn of the 20th century was 45.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't know those statistics, but Tom?
As you probably know, I've been a hospice volunteer for about 6 years, and I just wanted to ask you a question. Based on my experience at Serenity House, which is a 6-bed facility, I'm picking up on what you said about people die the way they live.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't agree more. Half the people in Serenity House, in my experience, sometimes more, want full-time television accompanying their final journey.
Oh.
Full-time television, and I have seen on some occasions people coming in at the end for comfort care saying, well, the 21-inch TV that's here isn't big enough. I want to bring my 42-inch. I mean, I say this with a sense of irony, but what do you think would happen if there were a hospice that didn't have TV?
Well, I think the TV question is interesting, because I don't think it's about television. I think it's about whether we're alcoholic or foodaholic or TV-aholic or workaholic. Those are ways that we stay away from the question. And if you've spent a life staying away from the question, that's all you know to do when you die. So, I think it is symptomatic of our culture that people, when my own father was dying, he wanted the TV on, and I knew it was because we wanted to talk about things, and he didn't want it. And that was his way. And everyone's going to find their own way. But I, my personal experience is that that's a way to stay away from hard things and to zone out. It's just like another drug.
That is exactly right. The week before my father died, I was down to visit them, and I had gone to bed, and I realized I had to ask him about his life with his parents. And some of you may have already heard this, but anyway, he was watching television, and it was Sammy Davis Jr. was on. This was he says, "Dad," I said, "Dad, I have a question to ask." I got out of bed, and he says, "Well, I don't want to. I'm watching Sammy Davis Jr." Yeah, exactly. But I didn't give up. I said, I asked him about what was your relationship with your parents. I always wanted to know. Anyway, so we had a little conversation. I went home the next day, and I stayed an extra day that I hadn't planned to. But I went home after that. And the following week, he died. He didn't feel well. They took him to the hospital. He was dead within 24 hours. And he was ready. He was ready. And I just took his hand and said, "Okay, Dad, it's time to trade this bottle in on a new model." He loved trading in a new car. It's just like this. He did not want to talk about it at all. So.
And, that gets to that, we live like we die. We come to the questions, and, some of us are asking those questions right up to the finish line. And others just, And another way to kind of look at that for yourself is whenever you're in the process of your own healing and illness, what questions come up for you? I was hospitalized very suddenly recently, and I'd never been hospitalized. And I teach a lot about integrative therapies and healing touch. And, well, I tell you, I asked for everything. I had healing touch. I had my friend Ginny, who plays the harp, came and played harp and did harp therapy. My daughter snuck her little dog in. And because music is very important to me, there are CD players up in the floor where I was, and I had classical music playing all the time. That just calms me, and I know it calms me when I'm sleeping. It works on me when I'm sleeping. So that gave me a good sense of, in an emergency situation, what am I going to call on? And that's why we talk about our spiritual practices. We never perfect them. I'm practicing yoga and breath work. I'm practicing healing touch. And so when I need them, how strong is my practice? And so I think that's, an adjunct to all this material is, what are you doing now to think about these things, to prepare? And that can run the gamut of material preparation. Do you have a living will or trust? Do you have a durable power of attorney for health care? How well have you prepared that aspect as well as your spirit? So thank you.
Insurance actuaries, say that if you're alive by 2012, you're expected to live for 120 years. For a female, it's 137, and for a man, it's
200. Okay, wait, I think there's more. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Maybe the possibility that there's another way of looking at the TV. When I was working on my doctorate, I didn't have time. I just had no TV for 4 years. And then when I finished, I felt so disconnected. They would ask the law class, "Do you know there's a war in Kosovo?" We say, "No." "Do you know there's people being killed in the high school?" And they're like, "No." It was like so disconnected. And then when I was able to finish my degree, I turned on the TV and I just watched it all the time because I felt so disconnected. And I noticed that when things, like at Christmas time,
there in the world that I want to feel connected to. And now that my kids are all gone, you know, if they were there and my grandkids, then I'd never turn on the TV. But the fact that I'm all alone and so completely isolated, that creates this need for connection. So instead of
I'm not saying there's one answer to the issue of television. I think each of us could tell a personal story about when it's been helpful. And gee, I'm watching the war this week, so we have a television in our house. So please, I don't mean to say there's in any of these things, you know, there's not one way. And I think the importance of conversation is, you know, Tom brings in his experience, and you've had your experience, and I've had mine, and we all bring that. And it gets me thinking in new ways, and you thinking in new ways. And I think that's the richness and value of this kind of group and this kind of conversation. So I'm not an absolutist. As a matter of fact, I read somewhere long ago that living with ambiguity is the sign of maturity. So I try to live with a lot of ambiguity.
Okay. Oh, I think you answered it. Anyway, I think
stand up.
You're the person. In your experience, if a person thinks death is the end, how is their death? It's interesting. I think whatever peace we come to, we carry with us. People who've worked that out and believe it deeply may live into this life a whole different way. So it's so.
So that one thought isn't that big of an impact. Like this is the end. Isn't necessarily of the.
No, it can.
This is the end. Isn't necessarily the biggest impact. It's everything else.
Well, it can be a big impact. It can certainly be a fearful thing. But for some people, and they've worked that through, and that feels like what they have accepted. That's okay with them. You don't really hear about this. I would get people who'd say to me, you need to go in and talk to my father. And I said, okay. Why? Because, you know, he hasn't declared Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. And I said, well, you know, if you want to bring that up with him, it's okay. But I'm not. So there are people who have even a formulaic way of saying what they believe, you know. And if you don't say it just that way, then... So it's so individual. And usually I found those people who, you know, they wanted me to go in and talk to had a pretty good workout about what was going to happen, mm-hmm. and they felt pretty comfortable with that. It was the worry words that, yeah.
I think you're right. I think when you engage in the experience, it becomes a teacher, you know, as well as what you're giving. I know a thought came to me when my mother-in-law was dying, in our home, and she was fully aware, and she was scared to death. That was the look on her face, was fear. And we felt like I felt she was the bravest person I'd ever known, because she was actually washed. She had no medication. Mm-hmm. She wasn't agitated. She just looked afraid. And so I felt she was walking that last mile herself, but we were taking her hand and getting her to that point. And I know she didn't want to leave. She really did not want to leave us. And so I kept saying to her, and my husband too, you know, don't look back, Mom, look ahead. Mm-hmm. Look ahead of you. Don't you see who's there? Look, everyone's there. Uncle Mike is there. Aunt Clara is there. I said, your mother's there. Your father's there. We're there. I said, nothing is left behind, lost, or forgotten. We actually go with you. We'll always be with you. And, you know, I have no idea why I said that. Afterwards, I thought about saying that, and I thought, you know, I think there's an element of truth in that. Because we're so connected, we actually get taken up. Nothing is ever left behind, lost, or forgotten, and so there's some way we constantly stay connected, and so it should be somewhat of a comfort that, you know, this whole thing of, well, you leave and then you wait this period of time to be reunited, for them, we're always with them anyhow. Maybe we're the ones that have sense that, you know. But anyhow, it's engaging the experience that becomes a great teacher.
And I think, again, this is where if you have neighbors that share a different perspective or friends or family members, engage that. There's nothing to fear. I mean, So you think they won't be in heaven because they haven't said Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior? Well, but why? You know, what does that mean for you? How do you think about God? That what is God for you then? Is it a God that waits down? Or, so I think those are always opportunities. And I really, this is such a beautiful approach, isn't it? To reaffirm with someone that, you know, I'm with you. And then to really, really realize you mean it. It's like, whoa. I'm not making this up.
In a few weeks, we're going to have a speaker named Michael Morwood. In one of his books, he was talking about this very topic. He says, Penelope, I don't know if he's really right. He says, but my attitude is, it probably is. Surprise me, Lord.
Yeah.
Surprise me.
Yeah.
I'm going back to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, when you were reading that. I found that lately I'm a little upset when I hear people speak to a person who's dying about the what's going to happen or encourage it. Like she was saying, you're going to a beautiful... Well, how the heck does she know? She's never been there. So isn't that a little presumptuous?
Well, I don't think she, in that reading, describes what it's like. She just affirms the fact that you're making a transition. And I think we always have to be careful. We have to know a person and understand their place and not impose our own. I think I offered that as just another example of where people come to understand this process. And a lot of people talk about it as a transition. So, you know, I think with any speaker, we offer just a plethora of things to think about. You know, I'm not a Hindu, but I'm really fascinated with their approach to life and death and what comes after. I've studied Sikhism because the form of yoga that I practice is informed by the Sikh tradition. And, you know, we can learn so much. And I guess that's where I come from.
Yeah. You know, speaking of Michael Morwood, and along with that question, Christiane, is I don't think any of us will forget when Michael Morwood was here the last time and he had the overhead projector and he took that pink transparency and put it over the image of the world. And he talked about God's presence everywhere in everything. And so, and then moving the transparency a little bit, it's not that God's not here, but over here. And having this transparency that this, you know, everything being permeated with God. So when you die, he said, you die into the fullness of God. And now the problem would be if we haven't recognized God, you know, in while we're alive, then it's the problem is not God's side. We die into the fullness of God. We may not be able to see that from whatever, you know, perspective, but objectively, we came from God and we return to God. And some of it would just be probably on our end. If it's like, you know, you can be in heaven and not be happy, then that's your hell, you know.
Well, and I think it gets back to how do you live your daily life. Kathleen Fisher talks about the experience of ordinary people. And in the Sikh tradition, the greeting is Sat Nam. And Sat Nam means truth is my identity, but it's also yours. So I greet the truth in you, the divine spark in you, Sat Nam. Or Namaste, same thing. You know, I greet the divine spark in you. It's really interesting to be in a culture that people really do that. And granted, it may be perfunctory at times, but generally, when you're in India and people say Namaste or they say Sat Nam, they mean it. You know, you're the divine spark, I'm the divine spark, and we're connecting. So that's important. You know, how do we, from the moment of our coming into this world to the moment of our leaving, how do we live it? How do we experience it? We bring that. Yeah.
It's occurred to me in working with people just briefly that the dying person can tell whether you're comfortable with your own dying and that you're not afraid, and they can spark that in you, and that then they want you around them rather than maybe a family member who is afraid.
Yes. No, I think that is very true. People, this is where our sixth sense or, you know, Pokinghorn's energy in the memory of God thing comes out. There's a sense, there's an energy, there's almost an odor that we give out that it informs how people respond to us and how we respond to them. You can say all you want, you know, I know this, I know that, but it's how you are. Can you walk the talk? Mm-hmm. Well, in the last few minutes, I want to bring us to some closure by recognizing whether it's Namaste or Sat Nam, the divine spark, and one way that we do that is to bless each other. And I'd like to sing a little song with you. I'm going to sing a line and you sing it back. But I don't want you to look at me. I want you to stand if you're able.
And I want you to turn around. Don't look at me. Look at the people around you. Move around. Look both directions. Because this is a chance to practice what it means to be in the moment now, to be with the image of God in each of us. Okay? So, as we sing, move around. Alright? And bless. Sing, sing, sing of a blessing.
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 A blessing of hope.
A blessing of hope.
A blessing of courage.
A blessing of courage.
Love will increase.
Love will increase.
A blessing of peace.
A blessing of peace.
Live, live, live as a blessing.
A blessing among us.
A blessing among us.